The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program, Roger Casement's humanitarian work in the Congo and Peru.
They trusted him and told him their stories, which they'd shied away from telling anyone else, enabling him to produce his report that changed the world.
I'll be joined by Roland Phillips, author of the book Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement. And to begin this evening, we're going to hear about the extraordinary life of Wexford-born communist May O'Callaghan. The Hotel Lux on Tverskaya Street in central Moscow was no ordinary hotel. In the 1920s and 30s, it served as a home to a diverse group of people, exiles or emigres from their home countries, with one important thing in common. They were all committed communists. The living quarters of the world revolution, so-called, played host to some of the most influential figures in the communist movement, including a young Ho Chi Minh and Tito. A new book explores the lives of some of the lesser-known figures who passed through its hallways, including one Irish resident who's never previously been written about in any detail. It's an international story about people united by the dream of communist global revolution. As we'll hear, it's also a love story which spans generations. The book is called Hotel Lux, An Intimate History of Communism's Forgotten Radicals. The author is my guest, Dr. Maurice Casey, historian at Queen's University Belfast, who joins me now in studio. Maurice, welcome to The History Show.
Thanks very much, Miles. It's great to be here.
Now, the book, it actually began life as your PhD thesis on Irish women and international communism when you learnt about a woman named May O'Callaghan from County Wexford. Now, until I read the book, I'd never heard, I'm sure like a lot of people, of May O'Callaghan from County Wexford. Who was she?
Yes, well, Miles, I got to month one of my PhD on Irish women and communism without having heard of her. Before this book, one of the only published references to May O'Callaghan referred to her as a mystery woman. My route into finding her was in an old out-of-print communist memoir from the 1930s, which was all written using pseudonyms. But in that book, the author, Joseph Freeman, referenced an Irish woman who was his boss in Moscow. So I used some other references to basically crack his pseudonym and figure out who this woman was. And that led me to a tranche of letters in the University of Oregon. And those letters were written by this woman, May O'Callaghan. They began in 1924 and ended in 1970. And those letters told this remarkable story of her long life. And they were written to a woman who she first met in the Hotel Lux. And so that was my starting point. And I set out to really uncover what led this Wexford woman who was born in a middle-class Catholic family in the 1880s, who had a remarkable education at the University of Vienna, what led her to ultimately be in Moscow in the 1920s?
And she was a linguist, she was a suffragist, she was remarkable in many respects. Just give me a little bit of background before she arrives in Moscow in 1924, the year that Lenin died.
May O'Callaghan studied languages at the University of Vienna, and she was in Vienna at a very interesting period. And she was actually the English language tutor to Ludwig Boltzmann, a very prominent physicist. She was drawn to Vienna in part because an older sister had ended up there, had married an Austrian businessman. So already you have a sense that this family was quite unusual for Wexford of the time. Her Austrian brother-in-law sent her to America to promote his shipping business. But as she was on her way to America, she stopped off in London in 1914 and World War I broke out. She decided to remain in London, fatefully, and she answered an advert in a newspaper seeking a sub-editor for a new feminist journal called The Woman's Dreadnought. That newspaper was edited by Sylvia Pankhurst, today one of the best known of the suffragettes of the early 20th century. And May O'Callaghan becomes a close ally of Sylvia Pankhurst from 1914 up until around her departure for Moscow. And so this paper, The Woman's Dreadnought, has also a very important role in the history of the Irish Revolution. It's really one of the most sympathetic to Irish Republicans of all British papers, and certainly all British papers on the left. And in part, that's because it had Irish women like May O'Callaghan on its staff. But what's also really important for where May O'Callaghan ends up next and ending up in Moscow is where that paper is published, which is East London. East London, which from the 1880s onwards became a major reception point for Eastern European Jewish refugees fleeing Tsarist anti-Semitism in the Russian Empire. Where they land and they end up alongside an earlier generation of Irish migrants who had left after the and during the famine. And so this paper speaks to a peculiarly Irish, Jewish, Eastern European world where people have these kind of hyphenated identities, which Mae O'Callaghan will spend her whole life within, of Jewish worlds, of Irish worlds, and of revolutionary Eastern European worlds.
And what takes her to Moscow in 1924?
Well, in a way, she's pushed there by a sweep of history that begins with the 1917 revolution. After the October Revolution and the Bolshevik seizure of power, they set out to spread the revolution internationally. And the main Bolshevik vehicle for doing this is an organization called the Communist International, or the Comintern. When the Comintern gets going, it's one of these early 20th century experiments in international organizations like the League of Nations and so on. And it requires a specific kind of staff member, multilingual, able to use a typewriter, secretarially trained, basically a job description for someone like Mae O'Callaghan, who had spent the war years working as a sub-editor for the Woman's Dreadnought in a multilingual world, who knew French and German from her time in Vienna and learned Russian in the world of East London amongst Eastern European immigrants. So suddenly this revolution, which brings to power a movement that sees its own route to victory through a wider European revolution in Germany, in France and elsewhere, suddenly that revolution is looking for employees, and Mae O'Callaghan is in search of an adventure, and she's in search of a form of employment that will also allow her to pursue her own political convictions, which are revolutionary.
And Mae O'Callaghan finds the Hotel Lux. So how did the Hotel Lux become home to so many radicals, including, you know, as I said in my introduction, a couple of really, really famous ones from all over the world?
So the hotel itself began life as a boutique hotel set up by a wealthy banking family. After the revolution, as the Bolsheviks begin to seize these large structures, be it palaces, former mansions, hotels, they seize them with the intent of, for a number of reasons, to house their new commissariats, their ministries, to function as meeting places for congresses, to become sites of their own social experiments around housing peasant communities and so on. But there's also the need that they have for accommodation for their international guests. And the early Soviet Union, it really becomes a reception point for people who are fleeing charges of sedition, fleeing taking part in insurrectionary acts, and are leaving for Moscow in search of a revolutionary home. And so the Lux becomes, almost through a series of both being designated as a dormitory, but also just this mass wave of migration from Western Europe, this wave of radical migration, it becomes this home because it was central. It was near to the Comintern's headquarters, which was about a 30-minute walk away. It was close to the Kremlin, which is the center of power. And it simply had the facilities that the Bolsheviks required. Now, it wasn't luxury. It was always kind of in a state of disrepair. The food was pretty horrible in the canteen, and it would be some years before people got their own communal kitchens. It had a non-functioning elevator, and it only really got worse over the decades. But at least for that generation that were there in the 1920s, it became such a part of their own biographies because it was such a unique space where you could go down to the canteen. And even though the food was underwhelming, you were sitting there with your spoon in your borscht and looking around you. You were seeing people who were the leading revolutionary
figures. You could hobnob with Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah, you could. You could have literally have a a pretty bland biscuit with Ho Chi Minh, yeah.
Now, she was there from 1924 to 1928. That sounds like a pretty long stay, wasn't it? Or was that the norm?
It was an exceptionally long stay. It was exceptionally long for a number of reasons, one of which is a kind of a practical reason, which is that she was very skilled at what she did. She was able to move pretty much seamlessly through Russian, English, French and German, which, again, were some of the most important languages for the Comintern. She also had a very wide social network, and her room in the Hotel Lux, room number 5, becomes something of a literary salon where Western intellectuals had meetings with Soviet academics and Soviet writers and poets. So there's that social aspect that keeps her tied to Moscow. She also was, and this may be somewhat confusing, but she was actually never an official member of a communist party. She was never a card-carrying communist. A lot of the communist activists who ended up in Moscow were party members, and so their home parties would recall them after a year or so. Once they'd undergone their training within the revolutionary headquarters, May O'Callaghan was never recalled, because although she was revolutionary and on the left in her sympathies, she never made the step of joining up to the party.
So there was no one to recall her?
There was no one to recall her, exactly.
But, I mean, one of the things she does, for example, I find this absolutely extraordinary, is that she is the lead translator in debates, these hectic debates, ferocious debates between Stalin and Trotsky in the aftermath of the death of Lenin.
Yes, so you have to imagine this is, of course, a period before we have Google Translate. And it's even a period before we have the kind of headset translation of simultaneous translation, which actually comes into the Comintern in 1928. So she just misses that convenience. But this was a very elaborate process where you would have someone like Trotsky give a speech, and people would kind of groan when he would get to the podium, because he would legendarily give the speeches in all the languages he spoke again and again. So he could rattle on for hours. So he would be at the podium, and beneath the podium would be a table of mainly women, people who were practiced in stenography, so shorthand, and they would take notes on the speeches in Russian or in their own languages. Then they would be passed through these notes to another room where May O'Callaghan was managing the English language translation team. And her team would then read through the stenography reports in the original Russian. All the English delegates would gather around her, and her team would then read it back, the speech, to them in English. So it was this process of consecutive translation, which was quite convoluted, but was as efficient a solution as they could have with the technology of the time to this issue, which was that this was an organization whose ambitions were global in intent, and therefore it needed to mobilize as many language professionals as it could. And that really, for me, was just one of these really remarkable moments, to think that in these, not only these showdowns between Trotsky and Stalin, but in the debates that decide the future of the Chinese Communist Party, in that room when those debates were taking place was a woman raised in a coastal village in Wexford. It's kind of extraordinary to think.
And she never renounced her Irishness. She had her own cultural life, didn't she? Was somebody who was very interested in James Joyce.
Yes, so she...
This is the early 20s. This is not James Joyce in the, you know, in the 1940s or 1950s.
No, exactly. She, when I began looking into May O'Callaghan first, I was looking for different worlds where I may have found her. And I came across a study of Joyce and Russia by a scholar named Neil Cornwell. And he noted that the first ever Russian language serious essay about Joyce was written by a mystery person by the name of Eugene Fogarty. Now, as I researched, I realized that this was actually May O'Callaghan's pseudonym. So May O'Callaghan was the first person to write seriously about James Joyce in a Russian language essay. She corresponded with Joyce, but really, as is one of the kind of key strands of the book, the most dramatic relationship for her is her relationship between the relationship between May and the Irish writer Liam O'Flaherty.
Okay, now the O'Flahertys, Liam and his older brother Tom O'Flaherty, come into this story. How do they fit in?
They are certainly, Liam blunders into the story at several points and causes a bit of a ruckus. But Liam and Tom, I often say that no cottage on the Atlantic seaboard contributed more to the world revolution than the O'Flaherty homestead on Inishmore, because you've Liam, who becomes a founding member of the Irish Communist Party, and you've got Tom, his older brother, who becomes a founding member of the US Communist Party. So Tom is actually the first of the O'Flaherty brothers to make it to Moscow, and he spent some time in the Hotel Lux in 1926. He was there debating different positions on the coming American Revolution with the Comintern. May knew Tom when he was in the hotel, and it's possibly through Tom that she's first introduced to the writings of Liam O'Flaherty. Liam O'Flaherty had started publishing in the early 1920s, and he was getting a lot of recognition at this point, and May O'Callaghan begins writing to him from Moscow, and she begins trying to arrange for the publication of his works in the Russian language through her very elite Soviet cultural friends. And so it begins this bond between May and Liam that has a very unusual consequence. And this is something that I discovered right back when I first discovered that tranche of letters that Mayo Callahan wrote to her friend that ended up in the University of Oregon. I found a very dramatic letter from 1928 where May reveals that a close friend of hers, actually a woman that she knew from her East London days, who also entered into the world of communism alongside May, a woman called Nellie Cohen. May had introduced her new friend Liam O'Flaherty to Nellie Cohen, and Liam O'Flaherty had brought Nellie to a London hotel room. They drank a lot of whiskey, sung some Irish songs, they slept together, and the result was that Nellie had become pregnant in 1928 with Liam O'Flaherty's second daughter, Joyce.
But Liam was not aware of this ever.
Liam would learn of Joyce's existence when she was around 30. She began writing letters to him. And he initially ignored the letters, but they did make a connection when this daughter was in her 30s, Joyce. But for May, when this news breaks in 1928, she becomes very determined to help Nellie through this, seeing herself partly responsible for the entire affair. So she leaves Moscow behind. She travels to London, where Nellie is in the early stages of the pregnancy. And then they travel on to New York, which is where Nellie eventually gives birth to Joyce in February of 1929. And so that is the end of May's Moscow career in many ways, but it has some extraordinary legacies. And she goes on to, for many years, raise this child, Joyce, in collaboration with Nellie.
And then there's a follow-on, is there not, into the next generation?
Well, yes. So I actually begin the book with a scene from May's life in the Hotel Lux, a very important scene with extraordinary reverberations. In May 1925, Mayo Callahan's close friend in the hotel, a woman named Emmy Leonhard, who was the partner of a man named Edo Fimmen, very prominent Dutch trade unionist who was a leading organizer in anti-Nazi resistance networks later on. Emmy Leonhard went into labor in the Hotel Lux, and Mayo Callahan called a taxi, paid for the taxi fare to bring Emmy to the Kremlin Hospital, where Emmy gave birth to her first daughter, Elisa. So that's towards the beginning of May's time in the hotel. And so May's time in the hotel becomes bookended by the birth of these two daughters, Elisa, born in 1925, and Joyce, born in 1929 in New York. When I set out to trace Mayo Callahan, I first called up her last will and testament from the registry office. And I saw that she had passed all of her materials to Nellie Cohen, her good friend and Joyce's mother. Through Nellie's will, I saw that she had passed her materials to her daughter, Joyce. And then I saw in Joyce's will that she had passed it to her goddaughter. And I found this goddaughter, Pippa, who actually, it turned out, was living just a short bus ride away from me from where I was doing my PhD in Oxford. I met Pippa, and I told her that I was interested in this Irish woman, Mayo Callahan. And she said that she had not heard of Mayo Callahan, but she let me look through some materials that she had belonging to Joyce. And towards the end of my first trip to meet Pippa, she told me as well that there's a box of love letters that belong to Joyce, and they're in the attic, and that I could take a look at them. She said they were written by someone called Elsa, and that immediately just set off fireworks in my mind. And I was like, do you mean Elisa? And she thought, yes, you know, you could be right. And so I went up to the attic with the torch on my phone and I propped open the plastic box, and it's full of decades of love letters.
This is why historians have fun with archives, folks.
And these letters were written by Elisa. They were written by the girl who was born in the Kremlin Hospital in 1925 to Joyce. And suddenly I had this, you know, this mental montage of the 20th century playing out in my head. And as I researched more, I discovered that it was Mayo Callahan who had introduced these two women to each other on the other side of the Second World War when they were adults, and they fell in love. And so this one relationship, you can understand it against this whole sweep of history. These two women would not have met were it not for the Irish Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and the Hotel Lux. It's what brought that love story together. And then I was fortunate once more, using that box of love letters, I was able to trace Elisa's living nephew, because she wrote in a 1970 letter that she had a new nephew and his name was Pierre. It took me some years to trace him, in part because he is now known as Pedro, but I eventually traced him to northern Spain, and he invited me over to his home in 2021. And what I was really, the kind of full stop I really wanted to put on this story was whether the other side of the love letters had survived. I had Elisa's letters to Joyce, but what had become of Joyce's letters to Elisa? I told Pedro that that was really one of the key things I wanted to discover. If I discovered that they had been destroyed, they no longer existed, fine, that would be a full stop. We spent about 3 days. Pedro had kept so much of material writing to his grandparents, and it was chaotically organized. I mean, I'd open up a box and it would have things like manuals for Star Wars toys belonging to his kids and handwritten letters by the French philosopher Simone Weil. These would be in the same box together. So it was 3 days before Pedro came into his kitchen with a black bin bag and he said to me, "Morris, I found the letters." And that was just the most extraordinary moment for me in my research career. We open up the bin bag and there I see the sign off, "Love, Joyce." And so both sides of this correspondence had survived. And so that's really what the book builds towards. It tells many different threads, many different stories, but it's in many ways, it's about providing a deep contextualization into this one romance. And I was also really delighted as well to find this photograph that Pedro had kept, which shows Joyce and Elisa on O'Connell Bridge in Dublin. So this is just a year or two after Joyce connected with her father, Liam O'Flaherty, and she discovers this Irish identity. And so she brings the love of her life to Dublin and they're photographed on O'Connell Bridge. And it's that location that many people will be familiar with. I believe that the photo was taken by the man on the bridge.
Yeah. Professional photograph.
Yes, yeah. I imagine it was. 90% sure.
Every family in Ireland has got at least one photograph in their of that nature in their collection.
Yeah, but for me, that photograph was just such an incredible moment because here was I, an Irish person who's walked across that spot I don't know how many times, and I'm looking at this photograph and I know exactly the story that's being shown here. These are two women in love. The other Dubliners pass them by in the street, might just see two friends arm in arm, but they're two women in love brought together by an extraordinary sweep of history. And for that story to survive, for the elements for us to put those pieces of the jigsaw together, that for me was what really convinced me that I needed to write this book.
It's an incredibly complex and an incredibly engaging story. But we started with May. Let's finish with May. What happens to her after the hotel looks years? Because I must admit, reading the book, I had a notion in my head, okay, 1924, 1928, does she fall foul of Stalin?
May O'Callaghan, in a way, she does get pushed out of the Comintern, although she leaves by her own choice because she wants to help Nellie. She did want to return. However, she couldn't return, and she later learned that's because there were rumours swirling around that she was a Trotskyist. Right at the time when these kind of rumours could lose you a job, but not necessarily yet lose you your life. Mm. So May O'Callaghan was fortunate in a sense that she leaves and she doesn't return at that time. Now, many of her friends, many of those she left behind, were not so fortunate. Rose Cohen, who was a British communist and the sister of her close friend Nellie, Joyce's mother, Rose Cohen married a Ukrainian revolutionary, David Petrovsky, and both Rose and David Petrovsky were executed in 1937. Another of May's very close friends, Sergei Dynamov, a Soviet literary scholar who helped her and Liam O'Flaherty get his novels to Soviet audiences, he also is executed. He's executed in 1939. And there's a letter that I discovered when I went to Moscow in 2018. I went to the archives, the state literature archives in a suburb of Moscow, and I discovered a letter that May O'Callaghan had written to her friend Sergei. And she had written this in 1936 when things were ramping up and life was becoming scarier for many of the people she had left behind. But it's clear from her tone that she doesn't understand what's going on and she doesn't understand the danger that's being faced by those she's left behind there. And that letter doesn't make it to Sergei because he had already been fired from the editorial board to which she was writing because he was seen to have had connections to another literary figure who was falling afoul of Stalinist orthodoxies. So May O'Callaghan survives this period by chance, but also basically by being the beneficiary of malevolent gossip at the right time. Many of her friends do not survive it. She spends the 1930s working in a left-wing bookstore. The 1940s, she lives outside of London with Nellie, with Joyce, and with Nellie's husband, Hugo, who she marries later in the 1930s, and who actually lived in the Hotel Lux as well in the 20s. He lived in room 349. I've learned all these numbers off. And then she settles into a cosy retirement into the 50s and the 60s. But she has this living connection to her life in Moscow through the love between these two women, Joyce and Elisa. She always remained very close to Emmy, Elisa's mother, who she brought to the Kremlin Hospital in 25. And I opened the book with Emmy's letter to Nellie after May's death in 1973. She, I guess you could say, maybe became more moderate in her opinions. She was a huge fan of JFK. She also wrote approvingly of Conor Cruise O'Brien during the first phase of Conor Cruise O'Brien. And she dies in 1973 in a North London nursing home. And there's only two people at her funeral, and that's Nellie and Joyce. And so it's this extraordinary life that ends in obscurity. I don't think that Mayo Callahan would have imagined that it would have ended any other way. I don't think that she felt that she had played a prominent role in history, because she wasn't the leading revolutionary. She was the typesetter. She was the translator. She was the editor.
She was the observer.
She was the observer. But through her eyes, we encounter this history through the perspective of someone who's much closer to us in temperament, in vulnerabilities, in contradictions. She was not someone like Lenin, who was an obsessive ideological thinker. She was not someone like Sylvia Pankhurst, who used to only sleep 5 days out of every seven because she had so much work to do. She was an ordinary person with these ordinary fallibilities, these ordinary moral compromises that come with living a life of commitment. And that, to me, is what made her so fascinating.
Well, she may have been an ordinary person, but it's an extraordinary story, an amazing feat of research on your part to tie all these strands of the narrative together between bin bags and attic searches. And this evening we've touched on just some of the characters and the relationships revealed in the book. The book is called Hotel Lux, An Intimate History of Communism's Forgotten Radicals, published by Footnote Press. The author is my guest, Dr. Maurice Casey. Maurice, many thanks for joining us and telling us the story of Mayo Callahan.
Thanks so much, Miles.
And after the break, I'll be joined by Roland Phillips, author of the recently published biography of Roger Casement. Stay with us. Welcome back. In 1965, 49 years after his execution, Roger Casement's remains were returned to Dublin and laid to rest with full state honours in Dublin's Glasnevin Cemetery.
Yes, the remains are now approaching the junction of Abbey Street.
A man once branded a traitor by the British Crown, Casement's life was one of intrigue, humanitarianism and rebellion. From his groundbreaking work exposing the atrocities of colonialism in the Congo and the Amazon to his involvement in the Easter Rising.
His chief wish was that when they had finished with him there, his body would be permitted to be brought back to his own motherland. That was his chief desire. He asked nothing more than that his body should not rest in that foreign soil.
I'm joined now by Casement's most recent biographer, Roland Phillips, whose book Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement, was published earlier this year. First off, Roland, what attracted you to Casement as a subject? I mean, he's a risky subject. He's been covered so often and so extensively before.
I've always been fascinated by Casement, without knowing that much about him. And when I was thinking about, as the whole world is rethinking the colonial past and the imperial past, I became re-interested in him because he was a person involved in decolonizing or humanitarian acts ahead of his time. So that rekindled my interest in him. And when I started reading about him, I felt it's time there's a modern look at Casement. He's such a modern man with his humanitarian aspects, and let alone the sexuality and different attitudes to that. And I realised that there was space for a modern look at this extraordinary man.
He was born in 1864. That's 160 years ago this month. Tell us a bit about his early life, about his background. He's somebody I must say I always associate with County Antrim, but it appears he was born in Dublin.
He was born in Dublin, left Dublin at a very young age. one of the things that struck me about Casement was his need to have a cause always at his centre, which I sort of track back to his childhood, because although he was born in Dublin, he left at a very young age. He was the youngest of four children. His mother was, I think, an alcoholic. She died of cirrhosis of the liver, died when he was about nine. His father was is a strange figure, possibly also alcoholic, who gave up a commission in his Indian Army regiment. The family lived this strange peripatetic life. They left Ireland when Roger was very young. They moved from boarding house to boarding house around the suburbs of London. They maybe had a spell in Jersey. So it was a sort of rootless upbringing. And it wasn't, he didn't go to live in Antrim until he was 13, when his father was mortally ill. And then he was taken in by his uncles near Ballycastle, the uncles who had sent his father £5 a year. His father seems to me to be a sort of remittance man. His few letters survived to his uncles asking for £5 to be sent to him here and there. So Casement didn't actually visit Ireland, as far as I can see, until he was 12 or 13 years old.
Strange question it might seem, but what kind of accent would he have had given that peripatetic background?
He had a straightforward English accent. When he went to Germany in the war to try and recruit Irish soldiers into an Irish brigade, the Irish soldiers could not believe he was claiming to be Irish, because he sounded like an Englishman. He was called Sir Roger. Everything was stacked against him.
Tell me about his physical appearance. I would assume from looking at photographs of him that he was a very, very striking-looking man.
He was 6 foot four, three or four, very handsome. He had a marvellous voice that people do comment on. It had a very rich timbre. And no one who saw him forgot him, because he was so good-looking and imposing in his height.
Now, one of the things that you cover wonderfully in the book is his early years in the Congo, something that I must say I wasn't particularly familiar with. This is long before his work with the Foreign Office. And, you know, the Congo is a big place, but he shared it with William Morton Stanley and Joseph Conrad.
Yes, he went there on the shipping company that looked after the Congo shipping. He joined in Liverpool. He worked there as a clerk. He longed to get away, I think. Again, partly a product of this background, that he didn't feel at home anywhere. So he went to the Congo aged 18 as a purser on a ship, and then shortly afterwards decided to settle there. And he worked for Stanley. He worked in building, surveying, and the building of the railway in the Congo, which was essential to get goods to the sea. And it's quite shadowy, but he possibly did a bit of ivory trading. He wrote a couple of letters home to his relatives in Ballycastle, not really saying what he was doing. But I think he had a variety of jobs, partly exploration with Stanley. And then the first real sighting of him is when Joseph Conrad, who was then had his Polish name and hadn't published a word, went to be a steamboat captain on a ship called Le Roi des Belges. And on his second day, Conrad's second day in the Congo, he met Roger Casement, and they spent 3 weeks together. And Conrad wrote in his diary about how in command he seemed, how much he knew about the Congo. He'd been there 6 years by then, Casement. And the stories he told Conrad mentions, and the things he has seen. I think that Casement, who was aware of some of the atrocities, although not yet working against them, probably was an influence on Heart of Darkness in those stories he was telling Conrad.
So in other words, Casement, long before he begins to work for the Foreign Office, is already well aware of the activities taking place in the name of Le Roi des Belges, the King of the Belgians, Leopold. But tell me how he then begins his investigation, produces his report on human rights abuses for the Foreign Office.
10 years after this Conrad appearance, he becomes a consul. And at that point, the atrocities are quite well hidden. There are very few Europeans allowed to work in the Congo, in the Belgian Congo. And I think part of Kasem's motivation for becoming a consul was that it meant he could stay there, he could travel. He also worked in a mission station early on, and the missionaries were the only people who really got to hear about the atrocities because they weren't under Belgian oversight. And Roger Kasem became a consul, I think partly with in mind that he could do some good. And when these reports began to filter out of the mission stations in the early 1900s, it made sense for the British government to ask their consul to produce a report in order to settle what was happening. And the great thing is that because Kasem had been there such a long time, he spoke some of the languages. He went further up the Congo than any non-Belgian European had been, I think, for about 10 years, and interviewed some of these terribly mutilated people. They'd had their hands cut off for not collecting enough rubber. They'd had to play dead while this was happening to them. There were stories of villages decimated and just appalling things. And because Kasem knew his ground so well, they trusted him and told him their stories, which they'd shied away from telling anyone else, enabling him to produce, in a terrible fit of rage and misery, to produce his report that changed the world. It enabled the European powers who'd sanctioned King Leopold of the Belgians to run the Congo in 1885. It persuaded them that things had to change, and there was a huge international movement, not quick enough for Kasem's liking, to get it removed from Leopold's control, which happened 4 or 5 years after his report. So it precipitated an international diplomatic push.
Now, the Congo, because of his background there, could be considered a kind of a home fixture. What happens then in Peru, the Putumayo region investigation, very much an away fixture? He doesn't have a background in South America. How does he come to go and investigate human rights abuses there?
After his Congo report was published in 1904, he spent some time in Ireland, which is when he first became interested in Irish cultural nationalism. But then he needed a job. He'd been a consul, so he became a consul in South America. There was a company called the Peruvian Amazon Rubber Company, which at that time was the largest company on the London Stock Exchange. It had floated at something like £1.5 million, huge amount of money in those days. And not only that, but it also provided some 90-something percent of Britain's rubber, which was in huge demand then because of automobiles and cabling, electrical cabling. And reports began to filter back from the rubber workers in the Putumayo region about this. And this company, because it was so important and sensitive to Britain, they thought they'd send their best person, who was Kasem. They knew it'd be Kasem because of his Congo report a few years earlier. So he was known to be able to analyse very, very difficult and appalling situations. So that was why he was sent up the Amazon to investigate this company. He found worse things than he'd seen in the Congo. He heard stories of babies being thrown into bonfires in front of their parents, people who didn't collect enough rubber, men and women being put in the stocks in the blazing sun and then being beaten between their legs. Just unthinkably awful things from this company that was in law a British company, but run by a pair of Peruvian brothers who were unspeakable.
What was the impact then of the second Kasem report?
The second Kasem report was a very sensitive thing. The immediate impact was it changed British law as to what directors of companies could and couldn't know what was going on. They had to know what was going on. But it meant that they were able to subtly sort of remove the company from the Aranis brothers, they were called, without them, the danger was they would declare it bankrupt. And not only would this be a terrible financial loss, but it would also mean they could have no further control over it. But so Casement, when he got back to London, after his report was published, he went to a lot of board meetings, and subtly and slowly, the company was removed before it went bankrupt from the brothers. And it made Casement a great hero. I mean, he was already an international hero, probably more than in Britain. But for this work, because it was so sensitive, he was knighted, he was feted in Britain. But it also had the effect, these two journeys had the effect of making him loathe imperialism, loathe the Foreign Office establishment. They were a clubby bunch who'd all been to Oxford and Cambridge, and they rather looked down on this man who'd left school at 15 and had this rather ill-defined life in the Congo. So the combined experience, it brought Casement fame and acclaim and honours, but left him loathing the British establishment.
So between the Congo and Peru, he becomes a cultural nationalist. When does he begin to become involved politically in Irish nationalist activities?
His Peruvian report was 1911, and immediately after that, really. So he comes back from Peru, he settles in Antrim. It's the time of the Ulster Crisis, and he is appalled at Carson and co. setting up the Ulster Volunteers, and he's a founder of the Irish Volunteer Movement. So he throws himself fully into Irish nationalism.
Let's move on then to his mission to Germany. But just to go back a little bit, tell me about his involvement with Adler Christensen.
Adler Christensen was a Norwegian sailor. He was 24 when Casement met him in the summer of 1914. So after Casement, he does a lot of recruiting for the Irish Volunteers, and he sets up the gun running, the Erskine Childers gun running that takes place in the summer of 1914. But he, by the time the yacht comes in with the guns, he's already gone. He's gone to America to fundraise in June 1914. And very soon after he gets to America, he meets on Broadway, I don't know who accosted whom, this 24-year-old Norwegian sailor. Casement doesn't know he's married and got a child in Philadelphia. He's described as a fleshy, dissipated-looking man. But Adler Christensen becomes the only romantic relationship in Roger Casement's life. And it's an extraordinary story of both love and betrayal. And it defines, I think, his emotions for the last years of his life.
Was Christensen a British intelligence asset right from the start?
No. Christensen was duplicitous from the start, but not a British intelligence asset. What happens is the fundraising dries up because the First World War, or the Great War, is fast approaching and starts. Britain declares war in August, right at the beginning of August 1914. And at that point, his mission to America, his fundraising mission is pointless because people have other things on their minds. So he comes up with a scheme encouraged by German diplomats in America to go to Germany and to recruit from the Irish prisoners of war in Germany, recruit a brigade the German government will arm. They're very happy to arm this brigade and provide officers for, to invade Ireland during the war, because Home Rule has been suspended for the duration of the war. And Casement is very, very worried that if Germany win the war, Ireland will never be independent, because it'll be bundled together with the mainland of Great Britain, and that'll be the end of Home Rule. So he is determined to separate Ireland out during the war. So he sets sail under an assumed name with Adler Christensen, who is his servant, acting as his servant and is his actual servant. And they go to Norway, to Adler Christensen's home country. And on the first day in Norway, we can tell, because Casement starts a German diary, And he writes on that first day that he sends Adler Christensen out to do some shopping, and Christensen comes back in a great state, saying he's been accosted in the hotel lobby by a man who then bundles him into a big car and rushes him off to this grand house and offers him money in order to see Casement's correspondence. And they say, we know who you're travelling with. So that's the story as Casement knows it. But a search in the National Archives in England has the documents from the Norwegian legation, where this rather puzzled clerk describes this Norwegian turning up and saying, I want to tell you all about Casement. And interestingly, on his first telegram home, it says, I suspect them of having unnatural relations. And then he's crossed that out, so that didn't arrive in the telegram. So Christensen was actually betraying Casement off his own bat. He wasn't acting as an agent for MI5 in that they didn't turn him, he turned himself. But what's extraordinary about the story is that Casement knew he was under suspicion. It made him paranoid because he thought the British were out to get him. And of course, as this was the very Foreign Office he'd worked for years, he felt truly betrayed. And as the story developed, it became one of paranoid depression and terrible mental health.
How many people would have known about Casement's sexuality prior to the dissemination of the Black Diaries in 1916?
It appears that nobody knew about it. He was very close to his cousin, Gertrude Bannister, who had no idea. One of his brothers often wrote to him and said, isn't it high time you got married? And his sexuality expressed itself from the few diaries we have, and of course they became contentious later on, in a series of encounters for paid sex, paid and fleeting sex. He never seems to have, maybe he didn't want to, but he doesn't seem to have, didn't have any romantic relationships. It was a simple series of paid assignations. And, yeah, nobody had a clue.
His attempt to recruit an Irish brigade in Germany obviously was not successful. Was it ever feasible, do you think?
I don't think so. Some of the soldiers who he went to see, the Germans gathered together all the prisoners of war. There were about 2,500 at that early stage in war, Irish prisoners of war. Casement travelled to talk to them and lecture them. And their reports that came up in Casement's trial made it quite plain that they were rather baffled by this man. I've said earlier that he appeared to them English. But that aside, he took such a romantic view of Irish history. He would talk to them about the ancient kings of Ulster and things that went completely over their head. But also, as one of them said, our families were getting our pay, which was why we joined up in the first place. They weren't conscripted men. So we were safe. Our families were getting our pay. We chose to join up. My best friend was killed by the Germans fighting alongside me. I mean, for all these reasons, it could never have been a success. And I think it was a delusion, really, that it could work.
Now, when he gets on board a submarine, a German submarine, that comes back to Ireland just in advance of the 1916 Rising, is it the case that he was coming back to prevent the Rising from taking place?
That's absolutely right. He realized, because he only had 15, 20 men who had signed up, and I think some of them probably were just looking for a free ticket home and would have absconded the moment they got back. The Germans had lost interest in him. The German high-ups were appalled by Adler Christensen and kept urging Casement to get rid of him, but Casement didn't. But Adler Christensen had gone back to America by this point with his German wife he met there in Germany, his bigamous wife. And Casement, who had spent the few months before his return on Good Friday 1916 in a sanatorium, he was very, very unwell, realised that without proper German support and German arms, the Rising could never work. And if it didn't work, it might set the cause back for a very long time. So he persuaded the Germans to send him on a U-boat in order to stop the rising happening.
On what legal grounds, when he's captured in Bannerstrand, is he then removed to Britain? And does his trial take place not in Ireland, not arguably in Kerry, but in London?
He's first of all arrested because he and the two men, Irishmen who came back with him, had revolvers, pistols, with them. So his initial arrest is for bringing arms into Ireland. He's arrested on Good Friday, so the Easter Rising hasn't happened. And he's taken to London for questioning, really, because I think they can't work out what to do with him. Remember, the military trials of the other Irish rebel leaders have not taken place. And when he gets to London, of course, he's a sensitive subject because he is a very distinguished man. He is initially put in the Tower of London, and it's a shocking treatment. He's still in his salt-encrusted clothes. He's waded ashore in Bannerstrand Inn. And initially, he's sent to the Tower of London and will be having a military trial. So now, after the Easter Rising and the leaders have their own military trial and the executions happen. But this is a real problem because a lot of people greatly admire him and respect him. And if he has a military trial, it first of all would have to be in Ireland and he'd probably be executed. And the government in London are very concerned that this will not play well and that if he has a civil trial, he will at least, the press will be allowed in and there will be a jury deciding his fate. But the thing he's tried on is high treason, and high treason trials always take place in London.
When he was on trial for high treason in London, he was at odds with his defence team, was he not, as to the nature of that defence?
Yes. First of all, he found it very hard to get a defence team because no London barrister would defend him. And he gets an Irish barrister, a man called Sergeant Sullivan, and an American lawyer who isn't allowed to speak in court comes over for him. There's a terrific fundraising for his defence. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle gives a lot of money and many other people who believe in him. And he doesn't really have a defence. He wants to make a great speech, and Bernard Shaw encourages him to write a speech indeed for him, pleading his case as an Irishman and that the court is illegitimate. And it's really a martyr's speech. He knows he can't win. And he makes a version of that speech after he's condemned to death. And it's the most powerful thing he ever writes, in my opinion. But it's a hopeless defence case. There's no question that he's performed high treason with the king's enemies, because he's been in Germany negotiating to invade Ireland. In the end, his defence and the appeal is run are left appealing, as Casement says, I may be being hanged on a comma, onto whether there's a comma in the statute which would affect whether or not you can do treason outside the realm. And this is their only line of defence, and it doesn't work. I mean, it's such a disaster in that his barrister, Sergeant Sullivan, gets halfway through his closing speech and then collapses, exhausted by the case, and it's a terrible mess. But Casement remains totally dignified throughout, yeah.
So what were the Black Diaries? How were they discovered? And what use was made of them to ensure that Casement was executed in August of 1916?
So the so-called Black Diaries were Casement's diaries from 1903, the year he did his Congo report, which were in a locked trunk in a lodging he used sometimes in London. And when word got out via Adler Christensen in the first instance that Casement was up to no good in Germany, he started being investigated by the brand new British intelligence services. And they went to this lodgings and found this trunk. And we know they found it then in 1914 because there's something in the intelligence files of trying to find a man called Doubleday, who Casement's been writing a lot of checks for, and they find some of his check recipients are Irish causes and so on, and they get very concerned as to who this man Doubleday might be, some sort of foreign agent. Turns out to be the local fishmonger. But because all this is in the files, we know from 1914 on they'd opened this trunk. When he comes to London in the end of his second interrogation on Easter Monday, the policeman interrogating him says, "We found this trunk, do you have the key?" And Casement says, "Oh, good Lord, no, but force it open, there's nothing in there." So we know that they'd already opened it. And in this 1903 diary, which is really a series of jottings, I mean, it sort of went to Traviata, doesn't say whether he liked it, bought a loaf of bread and so on. But the first 8 weeks of the year, he's in London. The rest of it, he's doing his Congo trip. And we don't have those pages because they were torn out in 1916, and we'll come on to what use was made of them. But from other entries in the diaries, we can assume it's probably entries such as walked home from the theatre, met a Welshman behind on Hampstead Heath, 7 and 6. So it's simple sort of accounting, really, for these paid homosexual assignations. And after he was condemned to death, and the law had to condemn him to death, there was a huge international outcry to get him reprieved from the gallows. And the Senate in America passed a resolution to get him reprieved. And Conan Doyle and John Galsworthy, all the H.G. Wells, all the great liberal intellectuals wrote a petition to the Prime Minister. The Archbishop of Canterbury made an appeal to the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister, we can see from his papers, was pretty keen to find some way of not executing this hero, and asked his Home Office if there was any way of finding a plea of insanity, which would have spared him the gallows. And the British ambassador in Washington was saying, you mustn't hang him because it might, well, the Irish-American lobby is so powerful, it might keep them out of the war. So there was this groundswell of opinion for him. Whether it could have saved him, we'll never know. But the policeman investigating his case was a man called Sir Basil Thompson, and the head of Naval Intelligence, who'd also interrogated him, chose to photograph these 8 pages of the diaries, and initially, actually before the trial, took them to various newspaper editors, none of whom ran a story. They offered them to his defence team, who said, we don't want to look at this. Everyone was aware just how explosive they were. But after the verdict and after the appeal had failed, these were basically sent around, and word of them got out. The Archbishop of Canterbury retracted his appeal to Prime Minister Asquith. The American ambassador asked for copies of photographs to be sent to him to use against those people in America who were saying he shouldn't be hanged. And it was a terrible use of material to make sure this support melted away.
What's your own position on the authenticity of the Black Diaries?
I believe they're authentic. They were scientifically proved to be authentic in the year 2000. Bertie Ahern wrote to Tony Blair and said, I think you should get these authenticated, so the debate is removed. And what we do have is all of a piece with what we know of Casement, the other pages in the diary. So I'm in no doubt that they're authentic.
The decision to go ahead with his execution, because as you say, there might possibly have been grounds which could have been found to mitigate the sentence in some way. Politically, how smart was it for the British government to go ahead and to execute Roger Casement months after the executions in Dublin, given the reaction to those executions, the adverse reaction having already set in, and now here they are effectively doubling down, as it were, on what had already happened in Dublin?
They were doubling down. Of course, it was a treason trial. And I mean, I thought a lot about this. I suspect, they had to execute Casement and would have had to anyway. He'd undeniably performed treason. He'd been in Germany for over a year. But also, we have to remember, it was 1916, the first battle of the Somme started on the last day of Casement's trial. Germany were such an implacable enemy. Hundreds of thousands of young men were being lost in the war. And I think it would have been very difficult, except for a plea of insanity, to have not executed Casement. I think he'd performed treason, as he himself admitted. I mean, it didn't appear like treason to him because he felt he was doing it in Ireland's cause. But at that crucial time in the war, a bad time in the war, I think it was inevitable he would have been executed.
You point out that he faced his trial with dignity. Did he face his execution with similar dignity?
Yes, he did. He was extraordinary. It's very, very moving, his last conversations and letters. A lot of his letters we'll never see because the British authorities destroyed them, thinking they would be too useful for propaganda purposes. But he knew he'd done everything he could. He was becoming a martyr. He converted to Catholicism the day before his execution and was given the last rites at the same time as his first communion. And he seemed at peace. He was puzzled. He said, "I've never done anything to hurt anyone, yet here I am being executed." And he wanted his small family to be okay with it. And it was a very, very moving ending.
Where did you get the title of the book, by the way, Broken Archangel?
Broken Archangel was something T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, said in a letter very shortly before he was killed in his road accident. He wrote to a friend saying, "I'm thinking of writing a book about Roger Casement. He seems to me a broken archangel." And, of course, Lawrence of Arabia and Roger Casement had many things in common, slightly shadowy sexual life, but above all, sympathy for the oppressed and colonised.
Finally, was he somebody who today perhaps might be described as having mental health issues?
I think definitely. I think in his time in Germany, he had what was quite clearly a breakdown. Christmas 1915, he was in a sanatorium. It was after Adler Christensen left him, really, and he was completely alone. And yes, he suffered very much from depression in those later years. And I think the energy he put into his great campaigns feels to me like staving off of that depression as he went through his life.
My guest is Roland Phillips. His book is called Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement. It's published by Bodley Head. Roland, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The History Show.
Thank you for having me on.
That's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items as well as podcasts are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Logan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.